I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The effects of climate change are all around us. Rising seas, temperature extremes, droughts, floods, and intense storms. Our guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Elizabeth Colbert, writes in her new book, Under a White Sky, that the crisis we face is largely because of our success as a species. We are now, in many ways, the bosses of the natural world, driving evolution, although nature has a way of fighting back. Since global warming is baked into our changing climate, scientists, researchers, and entrepreneurs are working on projects to alter nature in order to fix the problems we created in the first place, often with unintended consequences. Elizabeth Colbert traveled the world to find out about, quote, people trying to solve problems created by people trying to solve problems. She joined us by Skype to talk about those people and those problems. Elizabeth Colbert, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me begin with a kind of gloomy question, but are we doomed when it comes to the truly devastating impacts of climate change?
Well, doomed is a pretty heavy word, which I would not use. I think that we have caused climate change, a significant amount of it. As you alluded to, we're seeing the impacts of that, and we're going to see increasing impacts of that as we continue to pour CO2 into the atmosphere. And we will not get a stabilized climate until we stop pouring, you know, basically from a lot of CO2 to zero CO2. And when that's going to happen, you know, is a matter of a great deal of consternation, even as we speak.
I was thinking that even, and this will not happen, but even if today the entire world stopped using, you know, fossil fuels, would we still face global warming?
Well, that's actually a very current question of scientific research. How long will the world, or would the world, continue to warm once we absolutely stopped or reached what's referred to as net zero? And I think, you know, answers vary from it would continue to warm for a couple decades to several decades. So there's always going to be sort of some inertia in the system, but that would certainly be something very much to be wished for, that we would get to net zero, and then we could find out how long the world, you know, would actually continue to warm. That's our biggest problem, is getting to net zero.
Yeah, which I do want to talk about. I did see a quote, though, from the UN General Secretary. This was just a week or so ago. And he said the 6 years since 2015, this is, of course, when there was agreement on the Paris Accord, there have been six hottest years on record. Carbon dioxide levels are at record high. Fires and floods and other extreme weather events are getting worse in every region. If we don't change course, we could face a catastrophic temperature rise of more than 3 degrees this century. So even with the Paris Accord, we're still dumping CO2 into the environment.
Well, the Paris Accord was this effort to get everyone on board. And as anyone who's been, you know, in a negotiating session knows, if you want to get everyone on board, you have to sacrifice a lot to do so. And that's really what the Paris Agreement was. It was an effort to get everyone on board. It's a very weak agreement, just a voluntary agreement. And therefore, it doesn't have any teeth. Now we're getting up, as you say, on the, you know, we were supposed to have the fifth anniversary that was sort of interrupted, as it were, by the pandemic. Now we're going to have a meeting this fall, and countries are being asked to come with much more ambitious targets than they actually brought to Paris in 2015, and we'll see if that actually happens. But what the UN secretary was exhorting countries to do that, precisely because we are not on track. We are on track for, you know, tremendous amount of warming by the end of this century.
I mean, obviously that requires global cooperation. Is the United States, say, the main culprit or a main culprit when it comes to CO2 emissions?
Well, CO2 is not like other air pollutants. It sticks around for a long time. So when we look at the problem, we have to look at aggregate emissions over time. So since the start of the Industrial Revolution, and people have done that quite carefully, And in terms of aggregate emissions, the U.S. is still number one. We have still put more CO2 into the atmosphere than any other country. Now, nowadays, as most of your listeners probably know, on an annual basis, China is the biggest emitter. So we are the most responsible in a total sense. You know, we're no longer the most responsible in an annual sense, but we're still very, very high up there. We're very high emitters. And I should also add, we're extremely high emitters on a per capita basis, because even though, you know, China is ahead of us these days on a total emissions basis, there are, you know, 1.3 billion people in China versus roughly 300 million in the U.S. So, you know, you can easily do the math on that.
You write that we, meaning human beings, we are the fate of the earth. So it is in our hands to fix these problems that we largely created.
Well, yes, but as you indicated at the top of the program, you know, making the problem and fixing it are very different things. And, you know, it's a lot easier to break an egg than to put one back together.
Yes. I mean, is that a good metaphor?
You know, unfortunately, in a lot of cases, it is. It certainly is when we've, for example, I'll give an example. One of the stories in the book that I tell is about a species of toad, these enormous cane toads that were introduced to Australia in the 1930s, ostensibly, the idea was they were going to eat the beetles that were plaguing the country's sugarcane crop, which is a big cash crop. And these toads didn't do anything to eat the beetles, but they spread and multiplied incredibly. And they've become a tremendous problem for Australia's native wildlife because they're poisonous. And so the native animals eat these toads and they drop dead. Now that problem, once you let that genie out of the bottle, as it were, it's extremely difficult to put it back in. And that was, in fact, you know, one of the stories that I tell in the book about how scientists are trying to deal with that. But you can, if you just think about it, you can let something loose, but it's very hard to reclaim it.
Well, in fact, you begin your book with the story of the Chicago River, and this was more than 100 years ago. City leaders decided to actually reverse the flow of the Chicago River. It was apparently just, you know, unbelievably polluted. What happened? What were the consequences?
Well, that's a great story, and I think a very vivid story. So, and one that is pretty easy, you know, to wrap your mind around. So Chicago grew up along the banks of the Chicago River, which is a small, you know, river, but a significant one for the city's history. And the river flowed east. It flowed into Lake Michigan, which is also the source, was and still is, the city's source of drinking water. And as the city grew up, it just used the river essentially as an open sewer. It dumped all its waste into it. As the stockyards grew up, it dumped all the animal waste into it. And it was said that the river was so thick with filth that a chicken could walk across it without ever getting her feet wet. and this was, you know, not only gross, right, obviously, but it was a tremendous public health hazard because, you know, I think everyone would agree you should not, you know, be dumping your sewage into the source of your drinking water. So there's a lot of waterborne disease in Chicago. And it was decided something had to be done about this. And that something was this enormous construction project that built a huge canal which reversed the flow of the Chicago River. So now instead of flowing into Lake Michigan, it flows away from Lake Michigan and into the Mississippi River system. And that solved one problem. There was a headline in the New York Times after the canal opened that said something like, you know, water in the Chicago River resembles liquid again, or something like that. I mean, a very tongue-in-cheek headline, right? So it solved one problem, but in the process, it connected these two previously unconnected watersheds, the Great Lakes watershed and the Mississippi watershed. And that has had serious consequences since then.
Well, in fact, you say it's filled with carp. I mean, that's kind of overrunning the place, and they've had to electrify parts of the the waterway in order to, I wasn't quite sure exactly why they did that, but nonetheless, these were the consequences of reversing a river.
Well, the carp were introduced. So the carp were introduced in a, not unlike the cane toads, they were introduced to the southeastern U.S. in an effort to solve a problem or problems. Actually, there are several species of carp that were introduced from Asia. One species was introduced in an effort to control aquatic weeds because those fish eat plants, aquatic plants. Another species was introduced to try to cut down on the nutrient loading that occurs when you have insufficiently treated sewage. Anyway, and they all got loose and they turned out to be very, very good invasive species, very successful. And they've just taken over much of the Mississippi waterways, Mississippi system. And in some places, they make up 3/4 of the biomass in the water these days.
In fact, you have a picture. Yeah, I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say there's a picture in your book of just filled with looks like flying fish.
Yeah. So one of these species known as silver carp, which is one of the ones that was introduced to deal with sewage effluent, has this unfortunate habit that when it's annoyed or frightened, it flings itself up into the air. So there are stretches of waterway that are so where there are so many of these silver carp that, you know, if you take a boat through them, your odds of getting hit by a flying carp are very high. And I myself was out one day. Yeah. And got hit by one and it was quite painful. I got hit in the shin and, you know, it definitely packs a wallop, but I met a lot of people who'd been hit in the face, people who'd had to have surgery, you know, their eye socket was broken. So it's actually physically dangerous. And they really, so this brings us to the present moment where these fish are up and down the Mississippi water system, but folks who live around the Great Lakes really, really do not want them to get into the Great Lakes. But as I said, there's now this opening between the Great Lakes system and the Mississippi. So the point of electrifying part of the river, basically part of this canal that was dug to reverse the Chicago River, the point of pulsing a lot of electricity through that water is when a fish comes up against that electricity, they will get a shock and they will, it is hoped, turn around, you know, and go back home. So instead of continuing to travel into the Great Lakes, they will be sort of dissuaded from doing so. That at least is the hope.
And that is Elizabeth Colbert. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker. We're talking about her new book, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. The question that the book, I won't say struggle, but works to answer is, can we engineer our way out of climate change? What are some of the lessons we should take away from our past attempts to control nature? We were just talking about one. And you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskow-Wayne talking with Elizabeth Colbert. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, author of a new book called Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. She won a Pulitzer Prize for a previous book, The Sixth Extinction. Well, let's go from the Chicago River to our atmosphere. And this is one of the things that you write about in the book, which is trying to figure out when did we start altering, changing the atmosphere? Is there a time, a date where you just, you know, we go from sort of A to Z when it comes to that question?
Well, I think, you know, the short answer is yes. I mean, we have a very good archive of the atmosphere in ice cores. And if you take an ice core from the Greenland ice sheet or the Antarctic ice sheet, you get a extraordinary record, these tiny little bubbles of sort of trapped air that are actually a library of the atmosphere of the past. So we have a very good idea of what the atmosphere has looked like over time, what its composition has been. And you can see in those cores, this basically the start of the Industrial Revolution. So let's say roughly around 1800, you see CO2 levels start to go up, and they have, you know, gone up ceaselessly and relentlessly and increasingly fast since then.
Your book, Under a White Sky, is about some research in solar engineering, the idea of trying to lower some of these temperatures by shooting things into the atmosphere. What is this research about? How does it work?
Well, the idea behind this technology, which, you know, honestly isn't really a technology at this point, it's more of a theoretical technology, which goes under the name solar geoengineering, or sometimes it's called solar radiation management, is that we've already, you know, loaded up the atmosphere with a lot of carbon dioxide. I think everybody knows that at this point. Sure. And that is warming the planet. And as we discussed before, it also will continue to warm the planet, you know, for quite a while, because CO2 just lingers in the atmosphere for a long time. And so the idea is, well, if we wanted to reverse course, if we found ourselves in a situation that, you know, we found just insupportable, either for humanitarian reasons or owing to ecosystem collapse, the only tool that people have been able to come up with to do something very quickly to reverse climate change is to counter one form of intervention in the atmosphere with another. And the second one would be to spray something, some compound, basically sulfur dioxide, maybe, or calcium carbonate, or it's even been proposed diamond dust, into the stratosphere that would reflect sunlight back to space, and that would have a cooling effect. So theoretically, at least, you could counteract the warming effect of CO2 with a cooling effect of this sort of stratospheric haze. And that's what happens, I should say, when you get a major volcanic eruption. You get the stratospheric haze, and that does lead to a temporary cooling effect.
And one could imagine, without, you know, with a white sky versus a blue sky, that the either intended or unintended consequences of something like that.
Well, I think that this question of sky whitening, which is actually, you know, this is where the title of the book comes from, one of the potential side effects of throwing a lot of reflective particles into the stratosphere is changing the appearance of the sky. But honestly, you know, where we all live these days, or many of us live in urban areas, we've already changed the appearance of the sky. We already are getting sky whitening. So I think on some level, you know, it absolutely gives people the creeps, but there are many, many other potential unintended consequences of solar geoengineering that are probably a lot more dangerous.
But this is one of these kind of last resort ideas, as you say, it doesn't exist yet, but the people are thinking about it.
Yes, absolutely. And they have, interestingly, one of the things I learned in the process of reporting the book, which I myself did not know, is that people have been thinking about it for quite a while. This idea was first proposed by a Russian scientist back in the 70s, when climate change was really just beginning to emerge in scientific circles as a concern. So as soon as people realized that, you know, what we were doing was going to warm the planet, they started to think about, okay, well, how could we counteract that with some kind of cooling? And that was it's not a recent phenomenon. It's actually quite an old phenomenon. I mean, quite an old thought.
An old thought. We did a show, gosh, maybe almost a year ago, because literally, you could look out your window or your door, or just look up at the sky, and it was really clear blue skies. And you write, during the first few months of 2020, a vast unsupervised experiment took place as the coronavirus raged. Billions of people were ordered to stay home. And what happened was this precipitous drop, the largest recorded ever drop of CO2. Take us back to, I guess it was what, April, May, something like that.
So as soon as, you know, everyone started to stay home, people stopped flying, even to a certain extent driving, commuting to work. And a lot of also, I should say, you know, factories were idled. I mean, this was a huge economic hit, as everyone knows. And one of the impacts of that, perhaps you could say, you know, the upside of down, was that carbon dioxide emissions fell quite dramatically. So, you know, in the early months of the coronavirus, they were down, you know, I think something like 17% or so. Over the full year, we now have the full year statistics basically of 2020, they were down globally around 6%, I believe is the figure. And that's significant. But the lesson here is that because carbon dioxide is basically cumulative in the atmosphere, even when you reduce emissions, you know, pretty significantly, a 6% drop is a good size drop. You're still CO2 levels in the air continue to increase, and the you know comparison that's often used is to a bathtub. If you slow down the rate at which water is entering the bathtub, you are still going to fill the tub if the stopper is in, but you're just going to fill it more slowly. So that's what we're doing. We were still filling the tub last year. We were just doing it slightly more slowly.
But in order to, I mean, the reason we did it is that, as you said, factories shut down, people were not driving. That's an unsustainable way for humans to live in 2021.
Yes, unfortunately. I mean, and that leads to, you know, a big question and a very, very current question. You know, I was just reading this morning about questions about, you know, is there going to be an infrastructure package from the Biden administration? And the key question here in my mind is, if there is such a package, you know, does it take very, very seriously the infrastructure that we need to start transitioning off fossil fuels? If we use this opportunity, many people have said this, you know, this isn't an original thought, but if we use the sort of rebuilding and stimulus money that a lot of governments are spending to try to bring economies back post-coronavirus, if we use that to only more deeply entrench fossil fuels, we will have guaranteed a disaster. If we use it wisely to begin to transition off fossil fuels, we will perhaps, you know, avert some of these most disastrous outcomes.
Let me reintroduce you, and we've got a lot of questions and comments. I am not surprised by that. Elizabeth Colbert is our guest. She won the Pulitzer Prize a couple of years ago for her book called The Sixth Extinction. We're talking about her new book, and it's titled Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. And it's looking at this question about whether we can re-engineer the environment to reduce the harmful effects of climate change. Let me read some comments. It looks like we've got a caller that wants to join our conversation as well. Dave emailed right at the top of the show. He says, the emissions of the U.S. and other first world countries are trending downwards. Aren't we better off allowing these reductions to continue on autopilot and putting our time and money into continued economic growth, climate adaptation, and aiding to develop countries that we are abruptly cutting carbon, kind of picking up on what we were talking about, whether we can sort of let nature run its course, or are we just too involved in changing the environment just because of the nature of all the things that we do?
Well, I mean, this gets back to, you know, your question, how responsible is the U.S. for, you know, total aggregate global carbon emissions. And unfortunately, the answer is very. And if our emissions were trending down, you know, very fast, then maybe we could say, okay, well, let's just stick with this. But the fact is actually our emissions are trending down very, very slowly. And they're basically flat, to be honest. That's the way I'd put it. Pre-coronavirus, they were essentially just flat. And that's not going to get us where we need to go.
Let me read a couple of more comments and we'll get Luann to join us. Rick says, in the news today, there's a story about how an iceberg the size of New York City broke off from Antarctica. This happens periodically, so I'm not sure if it's a sign of global warming, but it's worth mentioning. Do you want to speak to that, Elizabeth Colbert?
Yes, I cannot. I also saw those amazing photos. There's amazing photos that were taken of this seam where this huge iceberg has broken off. And I also cannot say whether one could say that that is a function of climate change or not. But I do want to say that what's happening in Antarctica, the stories Scientists are looking very, very hard at what's going on in Antarctica, though the, you know, scientific research itself is quite punishing, because Antarctica has a very interesting and complicated geology where if the ice starts to melt, it will likely keep melting faster and faster as this water sort of seeps under the ice sheet. And that is a source of tremendous concern in the scientific community, because if you start melting Antarctica, you have many, many, many scores of sea level rise in there.
Wow. Wow. Marshall has a question referring to the Anthropocene. This is the age of humans, which you do write about this in this book, that we are such a dominant influence on the world. He's wondering about your thoughts about the technocene. I guess the idea that we can use technology to fix the problems that we created in the first place.
Well, you know, that's, I think, the question for our times. You know, what are we going to do about all this? And will we use technology successfully to get us out of some of the real binds that we've put ourselves into? And that is, you know, precisely the question at the heart of the book.
Yep. Let me get Luann to join us. Luann is on line one. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead, Luann.
Oh, thank you so much, Marty. Sure. My question has to do with, you know, since the subject is technologies to help reverse the percentage of carbon dioxide, the rover that was just sent to Mars, the Perseverance rover, mm-hmm. has technology on it that is extracting carbon dioxide from the Martian atmosphere and then chemically through different plates and layers, converting, putting out O2 and capturing carbon. And when I read that, I was like, I thought, wow, that's an amazing technology. Is there any effort being put forth to look at using a technology like that and ramping it up and distributing it here on Earth to extract carbon dioxide?
Luann, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Elizabeth Colbert, you want to respond to that?
Yes, sure. I mean, in fact, there's a chapter in the book on precisely this question. Can we come up with technologies to get some or all, even theoretically, of our CO2 that we put up there out of the atmosphere? And as your caller correctly points out, such technologies do exist. We do know how to get CO2 out of the atmosphere. For example, we have done it for quite a while. You have to get the CO2 out of the air in a sub, for example. People are breathing out CO2 all the time. If you let it build up, you know, they'll just basically pass out. So we do know how to do this. The problem is that it takes energy, right? So as long as we're getting our energy from burning fossil fuels, we are putting more CO2 into the air in the process of taking the CO2 out, and that, you know, has a limited efficacy. And then the other issue, you know, is simply a matter of scale. All of our, when you think about it, and I do ask, you know, your listeners to picture this, all of the infrastructure on the planet right now is not purposefully, but sort of as a side effect, devoted to putting fossil fuels into the air. All of our roads, all of our bridges, our entire electric grid, everything is putting CO2 into the air. As we speak over the web, you know, we are putting CO2 into the air just by using electricity. So the scale of the problem is as big as the world's infrastructure. And to create a new infrastructure that's going to remove CO2 from the air, if it's going to make an appreciable difference, it's going to have to be on a massive, massive scale. And that's really the challenge.
We're actually doing a show tomorrow on e-vehicles, electric vehicles. And I'm just curious whether you see them as, you know, solving one problem and creating another one, or we're kind of on the cusp here, but there are electric vehicles on the road. Do you see that as a way of sort of engineering ourselves out of this climate crisis?
Well, I see that as one of the steps towards trying to get our CO2 emissions down. So, you know, electric vehicles, you know, obviously run on electricity as opposed to on gasoline or diesel. But then the question becomes, where are you getting the electricity from? Now, if we continue to get most of our electricity, as we do now, from fossil fuels, I should say electric vehicles are still more efficient simply because electric motors are more efficient. So we would get a boost just by switching from, you know, gas-powered vehicles to electric vehicles. But if we're getting our electricity from fossil fuels, we are not getting that much of an advantage. We really need to be getting our electricity from different sources, and then electric vehicles could make a big difference.
Natural gas is such an important industry in Pennsylvania, and it has been described, I don't know if it still is, as kind of a bridge fuel, you know, getting us out of the coal mines and something better than that. But I wonder where you stand on not just fracking, but also just the use of natural gas.
Well, natural gas, as you say, was touted as this idea of a bridge fuel. But I think that there are, you know, unfortunately, a lot of problems with thinking about it that way. Now, one thing I will say, natural gas, the advantages of natural gas over coal, and here we're only talking about, you know, that head-on comparison, it burns a lot cleaner, and it does produce a lot less CO2 per unit of energy that you get out at the end. However, it is still producing a lot of CO2. And if we simply move from coal to natural gas, which, to be honest, in effect, we have done for the most part, you know, our emissions will stay flat. That is where we are right now. That is basically where we are. And, you know, one of the reasons that they have remained basically flat is owing to this transition from coal to natural gas. But it's not, once again, it's not going to get us where we want to go. Some people have called it, you know, sort of a bridge to nowhere. And that's the problem. When do you sort of get off this bridge? And another point that I should make, which is,
you know what, because we're up on a break here, and I don't want to interrupt you mid-sentence. We're talking with Elizabeth Colbert today on Radio Time. She's got a new book, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. And we're going to talk much more after this very short break and get in more questions and comments. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Let me just recap, especially if you are just joining our conversation. We're talking about this question, can we engineer our way out of the climate crisis? What are some of the lessons we should take from our past attempts to control nature? Our guest is New Yorker staff writer Elizabeth Colbert. She's got a new book called Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future, exploring the work of a number of researchers and scientists tackling this climate crisis, searching for technological solutions. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us 1-888-477-9499. Elizabeth Colbert, you were right in the middle of saying something and I had to take a break. Go ahead.
Well, the point had to do with natural gas, which the complexity here as well, and the reason that many people are concerned about our reliance on natural gas is that natural gas is essentially methane, is a very powerful greenhouse gas. So any leakage of methane into the atmosphere is actually causing a lot of warming. And depending on what your leakage rate is, it's possible that using natural gas is no better climate-wise than using coal. So that's another consideration that we have to take into account.
Let me go back to your book, and you have a really fascinating chapter about coral reefs, the impact of, you know, the acidification of the oceans on the coral reefs, creating this coral bleaching. But there's some interesting projects, some happening in Hawaii, some in Australia. Get us up to speed on that.
Sure. So that's sort of the center of the book, and this is a story about a project that was sort of nicknamed right away, the Super Coral Project. And the idea behind the Super Coral Project was that, you know, as you say, we've really changed the oceans very dramatically with our carbon emissions. We're warming it very fast, so the oceans are warming quite rapidly. And also their chemistry is changing because CO2 dissolves in the water and it acidifies the water. And one group of organisms that, you know, we know already really doesn't like these changes is these tiny little gelatinous creatures that build these amazing structures we know as coral reefs. And so the theory behind the Super Coral Project was, well, you know, we've changed the oceans. We're not getting the oceans of the past back in any foreseeable future. If we want to have reefs that survive the coming century, we're going to have to start manipulating reefs as well. And so this effort was an effort to sort of breed up or hybridize. There are actually many components of the project, but the basic idea is, can we come up with a way to create more resilient varieties of coral that we could use to repopulate reefs that are being already have been very badly damaged.
In fact, you write, the number of species that can be found on a healthy patch of reef is probably greater than can be encountered in a similar amount of space anywhere else on Earth, including the Amazon rainforest. I underlined that several times just to underscore just, you know, what we're talking about. We don't, you know, I've never seen a coral reef that I'm aware of. So the important role that they play in our world, in our oceans.
Yeah, coral reefs are really the nurseries of the oceans. Something like 25% of all marine species spend at least part of their lives on reefs. And I have been fortunate enough to visit a healthy patch of reef, and I can attest, and I'm sure any of your listeners who has also had that good fortune will agree, that it is one of the most amazing things you can see on planet Earth.
Really?
Yeah. It's fantastic.
Because it's so alive. It's so alive.
Yes. It's sort of almost unimaginable for us who live, you know, above ground and in the temperate regions of the Earth. But even I've also been to the Amazon rainforest, which is an amazing place, but you simply do not see the profusion of animal life in the Amazon. In the Amazon, all the animal life is basically hiding from you. But when you're there, on a reef, looking down on the reef, the colors and the sheer variety of life that you see is just really mind-blowing. It's sort of a psychedelic experience.
Wow. Let me read a couple of questions, then we'll get Marlene to join us. Earl says, what are your guest thoughts about painting buildings white to reflect some of the heat inside instead of absorbing it?
Well, there are, you know, efforts in parts of the world that are very sunny and hot. You know, you have to also balance off, of course, you know, we in the Northeast, we also have big heating bills. So, you know, in the summer, you might want a white roof, and in the winter, you might want a dark roof. That's obviously hard to arrange. But in California, places like that, people are looking into whether this could be something that a method for help, you know, helping to ameliorate heat absorption.
Here's a question from Dan. Can your guest address the role of animal agriculture on climate change and what's being done in that sector to fight climate change?
Well, that's a good question. These are all really good questions. Animal agriculture, you know, definitely has a big role, not the major role. The major role is still how we generate energy and how we generate energy for our transportation and for our electricity. Those are the two really big ones. But agriculture is also a big one. And that comes from two reasons. First of all, just clearing land for agriculture. You know, whenever you cut down a forest, that's basically a form of emitting CO2 because those trees were absorbing CO2. And also, you know, and it sounds comical to people, but it's unfortunately true and it's unfortunately significant. Ruminants, cows in particular, not all ruminants, but cows, they produce a lot of methane. They burp out a lot of methane. That's how their digestive systems work. And that's a significant contributor. So, you know, when people say one of the easiest things that you personally, a person can do to reduce his or her own emissions is to reduce the amount of beef they eat. That is basically, I think that's basically true.
Here's another one, a question. Dan. Here's a tweet. Climate change or global warming, which is most appropriate? And that question often comes up when we talk about climate change, global warming. Is one descriptor better than the other?
You know, I think that there's a lot of complicated politics behind this. But at the end of the day, I think the two are kind of used interchangeably now. At least I use them interchangeably. And, you know, the overall, the aggregate is impact of what we're doing is warming. You know, average global temperatures are going up. But this can lead to weird changes in the weather that are not necessarily all pointing towards warming. For example, there's a question of whether the cold snap in Texas that caused so much damage to their energy infrastructure, whether that had the fingerprints of a event, you know, attributable to what we've done to the climate. And so, you know, climate change on some level, you could argue, is a more appropriate term. But I think at this point, the two have sort mm-hmm. of merged, at least in my mind.
Let me get Marlene on line one to join our conversation. And Marlene, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, good morning. Just before this program, I was listening to the BBC NewsHour, and towards the end, they did a discussion of Bitcoin and how much energy Bitcoin uses. Evidently, it's a tremendous amount of energy. They had difficulty even describing how much it comes to be when they figure out how much it uses. And it doesn't seem to benefit anybody except a small group of select investors who sell it to each other. And it seems to be growing anyway. And how are we going to control energy usage if it ever becomes common?
Well, interesting question, Marlene. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Elizabeth Colbert, have you thought about that?
Yes, I have. And I'm going to be frank and say I find it very depressing at a time
really?
When this is the last, really honestly, the last thing we need is a form of currency that absorbs energy. And as the caller said, really quite significant amounts of energy. It is very difficult to know how because of the whole crazy way that Bitcoin operates. But I don't see personally, once again, one woman's view, I don't see any social benefit to this, and I see a lot of social harm. So I think when we look, you know, back on this moment and say, well, we were really desperately trying to, or we should have been desperately trying to reduce our emissions. Meanwhile, this whole cryptocurrency world evolved to suck up a lot of electricity. That, you know, what were they thinking?
Let me ask you about the 4 years of the Trump administration. It was pretty clear that President Trump wanted to roll back a lot of environmental regulations. I think more than 100 or something like 100 were reversed. We knew the EPA was basically working on the side of the fossil fuel industry in many ways. But how much ground do you think was lost under those 4 years?
Well, a significant amount of ground was lost is simply because of time lost. We were moving, you know, in the absolutely, you know, it's a little bit like Bitcoin. We were moving in the wrong direction. We should have been moving to strengthen those laws. Instead, we were weakening them. Now, what happens, you know, next is that, unfortunately, once again, a certain amount of time has to be wasted just rewriting the regs, just to get them more or less back to where they were before. And the Biden administration, you know, is already embarking on that. But we have simply squandered a bunch of time.
President Biden talked about 2015 wanting to get the U.S. off of fossil fuels by 2050. So in, what, 30 years. As you look ahead 30 years, what scenarios do you see?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I think I see multiple scenarios. I see, you know, forking paths, and we are going to be deciding, and I think we're going to be making a lot of those decisions in the next 4 years. So I advise all of your listeners to be on top of it and to be, especially in a key electoral state like Pennsylvania, you know, pressuring their elected officials to take the smart path. And the smart path would be, you know, the one that we've discussed, where we would be really trying to completely revamp our transportation systems and our energy sector to deliver much, much lower carbon fuels, much more lower carbon vehicles and lower carbon electricity. Now, are we going to take that seriously enough so that by 2030, you know, we are actually off of fossil fuels? That is a very, very heavy lift.
Yeah. I mean, the Green New Deal, is that the model we should be following, something approximating that?
Well, I think we need to be mobilizing, yes, certainly on the level imagined in the Green New Deal. And, you know, many people have pointed out there are tremendous whole industries, you know, millions of jobs to be created in this project of converting our economy. So it's really a matter of whether certain sort of entrenched interests are going to be going to predominate, or whether the industries of the future are going to win out. And so it's sort of a titanic battle here.
A political battle, correct? I mean,
And an economic battle. I mean, you know, it will play out in Pennsylvania. If we want to, for example, if we want a world free of fossil fuels, we have to basically, you know, shut down every well that's now sucking natural gas out of the ground. Now that, you know, is going to be a financial hit for some people, I'm afraid. And, you know, how are we going to deal with that? We should all be sharing in the pain and all be sharing in the gains equally. That's very difficult to do in the world that we live in.
Here's some more questions from our listeners. Chris saying, I've been concerned about Antarctica and Siberia, the appearance of large holes in the ice. They funnel sub-ocean floor methane up into the atmosphere at enormous rates. Can anything be done about this?
Well, I think that, you know, this is a really interesting phenomenon, you know, these craters that are opening up in Siberia that people are, I believe, and I don't know if this has been actually validated, but the theory is that, you know, there's sort of built up methane that's coming off of the permafrost, which from vegetation that didn't rot, basically froze. And now as it warms, it's rotting, and we're getting under these anoxic conditions, we're getting methane, and it eventually builds up and sort of blows a hole in the tundra. And you can find pictures of these amazing holes online. I don't think anyone would argue there's anything that we can do about to prevent that, except we shouldn't be encouraging that by warming the climate more.
Hmm. We've done whole hours on Louise's question. She wants to know your opinion on nuclear energy as a way to combat climate change. And Elizabeth Colbert, we have about a minute or less for your answer. Sorry about that.
I am conflicted on that one. You know, we've never dealt with how to deal with nuclear waste. It's just building up at all of our nuclear power plants. It's pretty dangerous. So I don't know that that's the way to go. And right now, building a nuclear plant is just so expensive that no one is doing it as a practical matter.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. My thanks to you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, Elizabeth Colbert. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker. She's got a new book, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future, and won a Pulitzer Prize for her previous book, and that titled The Sixth Extinction. And we appreciate all your questions and comments to Radio Times as well. For more information about the program, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. And we got a lot of podcasts there that you can listen to. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.